Today's study is based on the Song of Solomon, chapter 1, verses 1 through 7. This session is titled The Art of Attraction, and since it is important to understand the context of this message, we suggest you stop the tape and take a few moments to read chapter 1, verses 1 through 7.
All right. What do you think? Well, without further ado, let's look at the Song of Solomon. If you got a Ryrie Study Bible, that's page 1000 in your Old Testament. If not, you locate it back there. Three sections to your Old Testament. You've got the historical section, Genesis to Nehemiah. You've got your, last of all, your prophetic section, that is Isaiah to Malachi, where you saw Israel warned and said that they would go into exile, and there you see the prophecies that God would redeem them someday and gave them the hope of their Redeemer. That's the prophetic section. Right in between the historical section and the prophetic section, you got this little section that is called the poetic section, and it deals with some of the big issues of life. The issue of God and His worship is Psalms. The issue of relationships among people, how to manage your money and all the whatnot there is the book of Proverbs. You get the issue of how does a good God allow evil and still be sovereign. You got the book of Job. You got the issue about the mystery of life. How is it that your body matures about 40 years before your brain? That's Ecclesiastes, if you've ever read that. And there's another book that's stuck in there, and it's the mystery book, and it's the Song of Solomon. And it's there for a reason. Let me give you an insight about it. Not that many years ago, I was driving up a street in Denton, and I noticed one of the girls of our congregation. She was walking up the street, and I saw her, and I say that she was walking. She was kind of floating. She was kind of doing like this. And I knew why. This girl was in love, all right? And she walked with this just kind of euphoria on her face. And I called out to her if she needed a ride. She's going to give you a ride. And she answered back. She said, "No. No, I'll just walk." Because she was in this cloud and she wanted to enjoy it. And that's why it was so marked. Not that many months later, when I saw her out in the crowd at church, and her demeanor literally made me halt in my message and regather myself, because her demeanor was full of bitterness and anger and hurt and pain and grief. And I asked a couple of questions, and sure enough, she and her fella had fallen into immorality, and it had broken up, and they had built a bond that they were never meant to build through promiscuity, and it broke her heart. How many of you, in the whole dating game, have at some point gone through some tears? Could you just hold your hand up? Got a bunch of you. How many of you would have, but you're on camera? Go ahead and... You would have too. We got some people that have been through divorces here. Do you think that God has given us this feeling as perceivable as romance, this passion as perceivable as sex, and this institution as diabolical and as painful as marriage can be, and has told us absolutely nothing? Do you just get married and God just kind of tosses it to you like a grenade and says, "Well, fiddle around with it, you'll figure out how to work it"? Do you think if this indeed, like Peter said, that God has given us everything that pertains to life and godliness and the true knowledge of Him who called us, with my need of romance, my passion, my sex drive, with marriage, does He tell us anything? Yes, He does. As a matter of fact, He gives us an entire book in the wisdom books, and it's called the Song of Solomon. It has the distinction of being the only book that is edited and that is censored by the Christian church. Most of you don't read it, you don't understand it, much less would you ever hear it preached on. And yet, I taught this book at Denton Bible. Our church, I kid you not, went from 700 to 1,400 people in 6 weeks. This study went from, I think it was about 600 to 2,000 in about 4 to 5 weeks. And you're here tonight, not because Swindoll ain't coming, all right, if that's why you came. It's because we're studying an issue that is pressing to you, and that's about love, sex, romance, and as Doug called it, the sanctity of marriage. Because God has some things to say. Sometimes when I read this book and I teach it, I feel like Luther must have felt with the book of Romans, knowing it was the book for his generation, but nobody would teach it, and nobody knew what it says. This is a book of 8 chapters, taking a couple and giving you 7 snapshots in 8 chapters of their attraction, their dating, their courtship, their marriage. It watches them for two chapters fight. Be encouraged. How many married people do we have here? Did I just see married folks? A few of you. You get two chapters on how to fight. Incidentally, this book is meant to be preached to singles. You need to learn it when you're single. And so you see how to fight, and then you're going to watch this couple deepen their marriage after they've been married for a while, and then you're going to watch them go to the very end of their life. And the last chapter is kind of a soliloquy about devotion till death. I thought about naming this series From the Altar to the Grave, but that doesn't sound good. But that's really what the book does. It takes you from the vows all the way till, until death do us part. That's the Song of Solomon. This book will take marriage and see it as something that is divine. It's going to take desire, and it's going to liken this woman to a gazelle or a young hind, and this man to a stag. It is. You're going to see passion. You're going to see this man and this woman want each other, but it's cast in holiness. Desire is seen as normal, as right, as divine, as good, and it's to be placed in the right context at the right time. You're going to see romance, that after they get married, you're going to see the fires of romance keep going. Those of you that are married, what do you think when you go to some cafeteria and you see some young couple and they're sitting there talking and they're kind of holding hands and just loving each other and being sweet? What's the initial thought that you feel when you see that couple? They're newly married. Because someday they're going to get older and be obnoxious like me and my wife over here, you know. Because you've seen those couples eating together, and you knew unless one of them had to get Heimlich'd, there ain't going to be no conversation. Or unless one of them catches a hairball and commences to hacking, you know, nothing's going to be said. And it's going to show you romance, and it's going to show you sex. You're going to watch them have sex in the book twice. And friend, it will make you sweat to see it. I kid you not, I was teaching this book once in the Theta Chi fraternity house of the University of North Texas. This is the truth. And I was at one of the steamier portions of the book, and this guy in the front row does like this. And that's what I've always felt about the Song of Solomon. So, and one of the neat things, this is not Tom Nelson talking to you about sex and romance. This is not a dating seminar. We're going to do an exegesis of a 3,000-year-old document. I got a good marriage. I got at times a great marriage. And I'll tell you what, I'll be honest, I confess, I've never been to a marriage conference, and they're wonderful. Tell you what I can do, you can quote me and give me any verse in this book, and I can paraphrase you the verse before it and after. I've read it so many times. I've never found anything to equal the Song of Solomon. Let me get a question out of the way before we start. A lot of guys wonder, how can you write a book about the Song of Solomon to a guy that had about 700 wives? Hey, who should know better than Solomon, all right? How can you have a book about worship in the Psalms with a guy that committed murder and adultery, David? How can you have a guy write the church epistles that killed the first Christian and said that the law produced in him coveting of every kind? That's the Apostle Paul. This book is the essence of Solomon. It's the distilling in a man a marriage that was not made for territorial trade. This was not one of his wives that he had pragmatic purposes toward. This was a girl that he met in a very lowly place and he fell in love with, and he loved her. And it takes the essence of what love is. We're going to take two sessions tonight. We're going to do seven movements of the book. We're going to do it in 6 weeks. I'm going to take two tonight because they work so well together. The first is the shortest section of the book, and it's about attraction. How do you attract? And then we're going to look at how do you date. Okay? Now, if you'll just take verse 2 down through verse 8. How do you attract? At North Texas State, we have a number of international students, and they marvel at the barbaric practice in America of marrying somebody that you like. Their country, you trust your parents. They say, why do you get married when you don't know anything about it? Why do you choose your mate? Why not trust your parents that have been around a couple of times and know that beauty is deceitful and charm is in vain? Why not trust them? In their culture, you get married based upon character and virtue, and it grows in a romance. We get married on this thing called romance, and it devolves to where you can't stand to see them. Now, there, you might think their stuff is barbaric, but they have better luck and a better track record than we do. Because we're not sure what attraction really is. Do you remember in the book of Genesis, whenever Abraham sends his servant out to get a wife for Isaac, that servant goes out and he doesn't know who the woman is, but he knows what kind of woman she has to be. See, it's not so much that you have to find the right person for your life. You've got to be solid on the right kind of person that you will not settle for to any degree or settle less for. You've got to know that kind of person. And he says, the servant of Abraham, she had to be a believer. She had to be willing to leave everything to believe the word of God and follow him and to go back to the land of promise. And she had to be a camel waterer. Yes, she had to be a servant. And he waited, and God brought that type woman. She also happened to be beautiful, it says, of form and face, but that was just a blessing. All right? And so, in verse 2, let's look at what attracts this woman to this man and vice versa. May he kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. I love that. I've had my wife memorize that in 6 versions. All right? The couple in verse 2, 3, and 4 is married, and they're looking back on what attracted her to him. She says in verse 3, your oils have a pleasing fragrance. Now, in those days, men, you didn't take that many baths, and so men would cover themselves with perfume. When a woman says that your perfume has a pleasing fragrance, she's saying, you're a nice-looking man. Nothing wrong with a nice-looking guy. But if you look in verse 3b, this is the thing that took precedence over his looks. Your name is like purified oil. A man's name is a man's character. It's his virtue. It's his integrity. Ladies, the word character comes from the word carasso. That's a metal tool to etch something. Character means that it's something in your life that will not fade away. She says, may he kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. You're a handsome man, but what is better, what is purified oil, is your name. That means his character, his love, his holiness, his honesty, his morality, his temperance, his flexibility, his ability to be a good listener. That this is the kind of guy you want your son to be just like. This is the kind of guy that you want your daughter to bring home. That he's full of holiness. Ladies, that means that you can marry a guy that is 6'2", with long wavy blonde hair, that's got perfect blue eyes and a great body, makes $100,000 a month and drives a Porsche. However, if that guy will not listen to you, is sharp, is a pouty baby when he doesn't get his way, will stomp out, will fight you, cannot compliment you, cannot open his heart to love you, you have not just grabbed yourself a little bit of hell when you marry him. You be off of him like a dirty shirt, because I will assure you, after you are married, you will make love to basically the memory of the soul of your mate, because you make love with the lights out, and sin always looks ugly in the dark. You marry you a man of virtue. Your name is purified oil. Being single is tough. Been there myself. I remember being lonely, but I'll tell you what. A marriage to a bad person does not assuage the loneliness of being single. What's worse than being single and wanting to be married and not, but having hope and trust and faith, is to be lonely in a marriage and have no hope because you married a person basically on the accoutrements and not on their character. And ladies, when you get married, fellas too, that guy is going to put a ring on your finger, and the rest of your emotional peace for the rest of your life is that you are counting that you are wise enough to choose a man with a carasso, with an etching on his soul that will never pass away. Because what you're doing when you get married is you're putting a 357 to your temple, and you're putting his finger on that trigger, and that fellow can do to you what no demon in hell can do. But you're saying he won't do it because his name is purified oil. Now that's how you choose a mate. You keep looking here. When you choose the right guy, she says at the end of verse 3, the maidens love you, meaning all women would love to have you, and I got you. That it's logical to marry a man of great character. And listen, girls, if that guy you're dating is pressing you morally, it's because he does not fear the standard of God. If he will not obey God when he is dating you as a single, what makes you think that he will be married and face the confrontation of God to love you like Christ loves the church? If he will not obey God as a single, he will break your heart as a man who is married. His single obedience is a harbinger of what's to come. The maidens love you. She says, I am so proud to have you. In verse 4, draw me after you and let us run together, meaning that it's a privilege to marry you. 4b, the king has brought me into his chambers, meaning that it is a delight to marry you. And at the end of verse 4, the daughters of Jerusalem speak up, a plural pronoun. That is probably Solomon's harem. No need to try to emulate this, fellers. All right, but he has a harem. Okay. And they say, we will rejoice in you and be glad. We will extol your love more than wine. Rightly do they love you. In other words, it is logical. Secondly, it is a privilege, it is a delight, and it is right. It is righteous. How many of you have ever been to a wedding and you were thinking to yourself, oh boy, this is going to last about 45 minutes. You kept the receipt on your wedding gift. Do you remember? Because you knew that all you had was two combustible people that were going to just, you know, go off on each other, just this passion, and it wasn't going to last. It wasn't right. Rightly do they love you. And if you look at the girl, verse 5. Now, have I beat this horse sufficiently? Do we need to let the guys up just a little bit? Oh, the guys are saying, oh, God help me. Verse 5. Let's lean on the women just a little bit. She says in verse 5, I am black but lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar, which was a Bedouin tribe that had black wool, and like the curtains of Solomon, which were purple. The woman speaks of herself as lovely, but she mentions that she has a particular physical drawback. In verse 6, the most precious thing to an Oriental woman was her skin. That's why they covered it. And she says, I am black but lovely. And then she mentions what she means by black. Don't stare at me, verse 6, because I'm swarthy. Her skin was sunburned. She was a woman that hadn't taken care of her skin, that was her highest prize. And it tells you why, fellows, in verse 6. My mother's sons, meaning her brothers, were angry at me. They made me caretaker of the vineyard, but I haven't taken care of my own vineyard. Ladies, what does that mean, my own vineyard? It's speaking of her body. She had not taken care of herself because she had to go out and work in the vineyard. In other words, this girl is, what are the qualities, fellas? She obeyed the authority over her. If you're dating a girl that cannot submit to her father and be respectful to her mother, who can't get along with her roommates, always run a check on a girl's roommates. What makes you think she will treat you as the church does Christ, as a Christian husband? She is obedient, she is hardworking, and as a matter of fact, her physical appearance is downplayed like the man's physical appearance is downplayed. She has great character. When is a girl or a guy ready to marry? Three things. And I have 50-year-old people that are grandparents in my church that are not ready to date. I kid you not. You're ready to date and marry whenever. You have a silhouette in your mind of the kind of guy or the kind of girl you will not settle less for. Secondly, and we'll see it in verse 7, watch this. Tell me, you who my soul loves, where do you pasture your flock? Because Solomon is a shepherd king who cares for sheep. Where do you make it lie down at noon? For why should I be like one who veils herself beside the flocks of your companions? That's what the whores did. They would wear a veil and they would follow after the flocks and they would give themselves to the shepherds. That's where our term hooker comes from. In the Civil War, the prostitutes that followed the northern army of General Hooker were called hookers. And it's always been a custom of prostitutes to follow men and to give themselves. The prostitutes veiled their face around the men. And she said, why should I be like one that does that? What this means, ladies, is There are certain things, the girl says, that I will not do to get this man. He is a good man, a wonderful man. I love this man, but I will not have him if it means that I have to give up my relationship with God. I will stay single before I'll do it. When are you ready to date and to marry? When you know the kind of person you will wait for, when you know the things that you will not do, and you are willing to be single. My wife went through the sorority scene out at East Texas State as a Christian woman. And not that that's always bad for her. She felt that it was. And she said, I am looking too much for a guy. And she left and she came to the place that she felt she could consecrate herself to God that was as far from guys as you could come to. And it was. She came to Texas Women's University. And it wasn't co-ed, and that was as far from guys. And she said, God, I'll wait on you to bring me the right guy. Fact is, God brought us together. She said, I'll wait on you. Watch this. Fellas, pick a girl like this girl. Get a girl that has got that kind of commitment to work. She's a hard worker. She's obedient to authority. She is a servant. Fellas, pick a girl to marry that your pet name instinctively will be like sweetie, sweetheart. I notice with bad couples with mean wives, you never can call them a pet name. What do you call a woman that's got the soul of a pterodactyl, you know? That's the queen of the harpies. What do you say to her? This is a sweetie. This is my doll. I call my wife, I call her sugar. I call her honey. I call her sweetie. I call her doll. I call her little doll. Now, that's the way that I feel toward her. That's the kind of girl that he picks. You know what made me fall in love with my wife? When I was at Campus Crusade for Christ in 1972, we would have Campus Crusade meetings, and I would notice my wife, Teresa Newman, I married a girl with the same initials as me to save on bath towels and luggage. This girl would pull up in her 1970-whatever Torino, and there would just all this gaggle of girls would pile out because she would haul them around. And our Campus Crusade director, when he needed anything done, he would go to my wife to do it because she would do it. She was faithful. She's a pretty girl, but I didn't notice her right at first. But I kept watching her, and I kept watching her. And I said, man, there's a character to her. And I would want a daughter to be just like that girl. I liked her. She was my friend. I admired her. If I had a son, I would want him to bring home a woman just like my wife. That's the way that you pick a girl. Let me put it to you like this. Let me stop at this point. Do y'all see what attraction is? The guy has a name, and the girl has a heart. The guy's name is greater than his looks. The girl's heart is greater than her skin. And they come together on carasso, on something that will not bend. If you're going to start a fire, how do you start a fire? If you take kindling and spread lighter fluid all over it and light it, it looks like you've got a roaring blaze that goes out in a second. That's what premarital sex is. It looks just like love. You can say, I love you. You can say all kind of things in the midst of passion, but it'll go out. To build a fire, you get these big, deep embers, and you let them glow red and hot, and you can pile all the wood in the world, and that thing literally can burn infinitely as long as you have wood. That's what a marriage is. You've got to have the embers of love and of morality and holiness and devotion. You've got to have these embers of honesty and forgiveness and the ability to share back and forth. Girls, my wife has missed one quiet time in 20 years of marriage. That's all. She made a vow she would never miss a day without a quiet time. One time years ago, she got operated on, and they cut an ovarian artery. And in the recovery room, she started going into shock. And before they died, they took her in and saved her life. I gave her the day off. I felt that was big on my part. The next day, she couldn't even focus her eyes, and she got one of the guys in our church came to visit her, and he read to her from the Scriptures. That was her way of having a quiet time. She's got that kind of quality heart to her. That's attraction. One of the great words I ever heard on marriage. Whenever you pick a mate, here's the way you do it. You run as fast as you can for Jesus Christ. Commit your life to Him, love Him, sell out to Him, devoted to Him, and you run as fast as you can, and you look on your right and left and see who's running the same speed, and you just wave at them. And if they stay up with you, after a while, you say, come on over, and you run together. And what I wanted to do was win people to Christ. What my wife wanted to do was win people to Christ. She wanted to spend her life in the sharing of the gospel. I wanted to do it in the sharing of the gospel. She wanted to bring kids to the Lord. I wanted to have children that love the Lord. She wanted a Christian home. I wanted that. And we just said, heck, let's do it together. And we did it together. That's the way you get married. When I was a kid in high school, I had a coach. He gave one of the great statements I ever heard about true marriage. I was I guess I couldn't have been 16 years old. I'll never forget that coach saying. He said, fellers, he's talking to us about marriage. And all those little fuzzy cheek guys who looked up. He said, let me tell you, now this is jock talking to jocks, all right? He said, there's going to be a day when you guys are going to be sitting on a pot and that woman's going to be brushing her teeth in the same bathroom. And he said, when that comes, the honeymoon is over. I'm writing that down. Listen, when you get married, whoever does it, people are filing out, man. When you get married, some guy, me or somebody, is going to stand at a place like this, put a ring on your finger, and I want you to remember something. You're going to get married at the height of your physical beauty. That guy will have gotten himself as good looking as he can get. That woman's been getting ready since 9 a.m., and she looks wonderful. She's going to be on time because they're going to hit the deal, and she's coming, all right? That's going to be the most. You're probably going to get married between about 22 and about, even if you're, heck, I'm 44, you get married in 42, around it, you're going to get married at the best you can be. Everything from that moment on is downhill, all right? Because you're going to start going down physically. And so if you have built your marriage on physical attributes, and what is worse, if you built it on passion, you're in a heap of trouble. And that's why our country has got the divorce rate that it does. One of the problems I have with movies and the media isn't just because it titillates you with sex, it's because it's wrong. It's a lie. And we see this junk. The women on these shows all have male sex drives. They all do. The steam comes off of them. I go, wait a minute. My two sons are watching it. You're seeing something, and I'm saying, it don't work that way, fellers. It's a lie. That's why the woman in real life has been married 6 times, because you can't build a marriage. Who are the prettiest, the sharpest bodies in the world there in Beverly Hills? Where are the worst marriages on this planet that a comedian will use for opening patter for his monologue? Beverly Hills. It don't work. Sin is always ugly in the dark. You ever heard that women are beautiful when they're mad? Forget it. They're toads when they're mad.